Kevin Rose leaves Dig, Time Warner cuts streaming in half, and Verizon announces the first real LTE phone. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 28 for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. As usual, I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me are two people this week. Sitting to my right, as usual, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, what's up?
Not too much. Not too much at all. And sitting to my left, a new guest this week, Mr. Anthony Margusio.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
It is going wonderful. Thank
you. Super well.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for asking. Thank you for being glad to be here. It's always nice whenever people enjoy being on the show.
Most people hate it.
That's true. Most people don't come back.
If you hate it so much, Ryan, why are you a permaguest?
I'm a permaguest.
Oh, permaguest. No. That's a good word. So, Anthony, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself since you're new here?
All right. I'm a web developer. I have a background in computer engineering, a master's degree in engineering management, and I'm one of the lead developers in Northrop Grumman's web COE.
Nice. So you're actually talented and you have things to say that are, what's the word I'm looking for? Like informed.
Sure. We'll go with that.
You're not just a random person I pulled off the street. All right. So let's jump right in. There are a lot of good stories this week. Top story of the week, Kevin Rose resigns from Dig. Did you either of you guys hear about this recently in the news?
Yep.
I mean, it's not really the news like the local news, kind of more like the tech news.
It's local to me, dude.
That's true. The internet is local to me. But yeah, apparently, here's how I found out about this. I just, for some odd reason, opened up Twitter on my phone, and I saw Kevin Rose tweet out, "Seriously, though, thanks for all the kind wishes. Excited to explore some new ideas that you'll hopefully enjoy. More news soon." And I'm thinking, what the heck is this all about? I immediately went to Google News, typed in Kevin Rose, and found articles. Kevin just resigned from Dig.
Yeah.
Like an hour before I saw that tweet.
Yeah, my Google Reader feed lit up.
Yeah, that was nuts.
It was similar to like last week with Topolsky.
Yeah, with the Engadget guys.
Yeah, it's like both of them, I think they tweeted something like, "Oh, thanks for the well wishes." And I'm like, damn it, something happened.
Right. Yeah, whenever you see something like that, you wonder what is going on. Like, Kevin. Yeah, Kevin. Anthony.
And we have Kevin Rose here in the studio.
I was thinking about trying to get him on the show. He might do it now. He's in between projects. Come on. So, Anthony, what do you think about this? Do you think Dig is going under now that Kevin's not at the helm?
I'm kind of wondering if that's the case. There was an article on TechCrunch that basically said, you know, Dig is done now that he's gone. And, you know, it has definitely been declining the last couple of years. So, you know, it's... I'm eager to see what happens, but I'm not very hopeful.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know which side of the fence I fall on, because if you read Kevin Rose's blog posts where he talked about this, you know, he kind of says, and even in his interviews, that he hasn't been doing anything at Dig for the past 6 months. Like ever since the new CEO took over, he's just been an advisor, really. So I don't know. I mean, if they do another Dig 4, you know, another version that sucks as much as Dig 4, they're probably going to go under.
Well, I mean, I don't know that they've completely remedied the problem they introduced, what, 8 months ago?
Yeah.
Or when did Dig 4 come out? It wasn't even 8 months.
Seemed like yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it still seems like a slow-motion train wreck.
Yeah, they never really got rid of Dig 4. They just tried to not randomly, but change one thing at a time.
Yeah. I honestly haven't visited the site. Like, when it blew up, I saw something about Reddit, like, which I'd never heard of, and I went over to Reddit, and that's where I've been ever since.
The whole concept of Dig is a really great idea, except that I think now Twitter kind of beats them at their own game.
Yeah, everything, you get everything quicker on Twitter.
Well, that's something former guest Matt Hunt was talking about related to Slashdot, because Slashdot is actually kind of similar in some ways to Dig, although it's definitely tech news centric, or at least science news.
Right.
And they've kind of been on like the, you know, downward spiral as well. In terms of like latest and greatest news, all these other media sources are just so much faster. Google News, even I see stuff pop up there before I see it, you know, even on the tech sites a lot of times.
Yeah, Slashdot is definitely slow, and Dig, I mean, I don't know, from what their new CEO says, what is his name anyways? Matt Williams. Mm-hmm. He says very soon they're coming out with a new version of Dig. So we'll see what happens.
Very soon it will get better, we promise.
That's what they've been saying for the past 8 months. So moving on, another interesting story for a social networking site, Flickr. Apparently, the head of Flickr is no longer the head of Flickr. And people are saying now that this is a great time for Facebook to buy them. Do either of you guys use Flickr?
No.
I do a little. I actually have, like, and probably, it's funny this article came up because probably, like, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, I'm like, I really need to find out why Flickr is so awesome. Like, well, why people say it's awesome.
Right.
And the thing that impressed me the most are the live editing tools. Like, if you upload pictures and you want to do things with them, like,
I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah, like, you can do, like, I don't want to say, maybe Photoshop-esque is too strong of a word, even though it's
like
not.
Like, MS Paint-esque.
MS Paint-esque. Like, you can do things to the pictures in the cloud, which I think is powerful. Because, you know, you can upload something and then, like, edit and batch edit and stuff like that. Like, there's batch processing, which is cool. So if you're a photographer, I think there's some definite, like, draw there. I think the layout of Flickr, like, the whole photo stream and albums and collections and all the different ways you can organize your pictures is really confusing. And I don't think that it, like, draws the eye to the picture or anything. Like, there's nothing special about Flickr that way, but the editing tools, I think, are special.
Yeah, I agree with you on the albums and everything being confusing. I have no clue what the difference between an album or a stream or a collection. Like, yeah. I can't find people's photos when I want to look for them because I don't know what to click on.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were saying that Facebook should buy them to add all of the Flickr power into Facebook photos.
Yeah, that's. I think one of Facebook's, like, you know, worst aspects of their photo management is that they don't have any, like, editing, like, other than, like, rotate and tag.
Yeah.
That's really it.
Yeah, you can crop for your profile picture, but
right.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, when I think of Facebook photo tools, I mean, I wouldn't put a picture off of my digital SLR on Facebook. I would put it on Flickr versus, you know, maybe something on my cell phone might go up on Facebook. So, you know, Facebook says they have HD features. I don't know. They seem kind of hokey to me. Have you used them much, Kevin?
The last time I uploaded some pictures, I did check the box for upload them in HD. And, you know, it said this may take longer. It didn't really take longer. But all it does is add a link on the bottom right-hand corner of a photo page that says view in original resolution. Like, if you're not looking for it, you're not going to see it. And when you do that, you just see the original image you uploaded. Like, that's all it does.
This is in Facebook?
In Facebook, yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't even like the new update to Facebook Photos, how it's, like, Lightbox-esque. When you click on a photo, it doesn't take you to a page with the photo. It just opens up a layer on top of Facebook.
Oh, dude, I hate that.
I hate that.
Yeah, I actually like it.
Really? See, what I hate about it is if I want to link somebody an image, you can't anymore.
Okay.
Because
the
image is not an image. The image is a background to a div, so you can't right-click on it and copy the URL or anything. It's, like, not there.
Now, in terms of browsing, I think it's a very nice feature because I found myself, you know, I'm browsing through the news feed. I click on an image. It would take me to another page. And then when I want to go back to the original news feed, it wasn't always consistent. I might, you know, end up at the top or got to scroll. And
I agree with that, too.
Now it doesn't interrupt my browsing.
I do like it from the news feed. What I wish, though, is that it was just, like, a preview of the picture. Not like
the full-on representation of it.
Way it is now, because they're also using that if you click on the photos link on somebody's page and you click on their album, it doesn't take you to the album page. It opens up that stupid layer again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, I kind of wish they would use the layer on the newsfeed, so you're right, so it doesn't interrupt your newsfeed reading. But when you really want to look at photos, when you're looking at albums, show me a picture on a page.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I want. Then I can click back and forward and browse stuff. I don't know. I think it would be, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think it would be good for Facebook to buy Flickr and integrate there.
I think it'd be good for Flickr too.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, like, pro photographers, I don't think they're all, like, everyone uses Flickr. You know, I don't think it's like, they may have, like, a slight majority, but they don't have, like, a commanding, like, you know, 90% share or something.
Yeah, I mean, most pro photographers use websites that allow you to have albums and stuff that you can buy from there. Like Flickr, you can't order prints and do things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens soon. So this next article, It can be found in a lot of different places. The place that I linked was a website called the Daily Caller, which kind of sounds like a communist paper, like the Daily Worker. I was wondering whether they were or not, but I didn't look into it. So I apologize if I linked to a communist webpage. But apparently the education department for the country, we're talking about the country here, not just an individual state, is trying to put in some rules, and the president is behind it, that schools have to be able to, and I quote, creep on students. So they're saying for things like harassment, where the schools have to intervene if things happen in the school. You know, somebody harasses somebody, they have to stop it. Somebody writes a nasty note, you know, they have to stop it. They have to do things like that. But the new laws that they're trying to put into place are so the school administrators can go on people's Facebook pages and intervene with things that don't happen at school, with things that happen when the students aren't at school. Anthony, what do you think about this whole?
Well, I don't really know how they can enforce this. I mean, the article mentions that they would be held accountable for comments made in private conversation. I mean,
that's the point of a private conversation.
Yeah, it blows my mind. I mean, I'm all for anti-bullying measures, but you know, it just seems like they're focusing on maybe a symptom and not an underlying problem.
I think this is a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
What do you think, Ryan?
I'd agree. one thing that I would support, or maybe that they should augment this with, is an opt-in, opt-out thing on the part of the parents of the bullier or bullyee.
Bullyee.
But the bullyee, the bullied.
Oh, there you go. It's a better word.
Because basically anything that somebody, you know, puts on your profile is public then, essentially. Well, I guess dependent upon their settings, but if it's on your profile, it's, you can see it, so you know you have a right to look at the content, essentially. So if they add some kind of thing into your profile where your, maybe your parents manage your profile, sort of like a parental control, and then if you opt in, it like logs all this sort of stuff, and then if the parents see a problem, or if then the parents opt in to like say, oh yeah, he goes to this school, and then it allows the school to like monitor that person's page. Fine. If the parents want to opt into this, fine. But there should be no liability upon the part of the school and no forced use of it on the part of the parents or the child.
And going off of those 2 points that you just made, the article points out that if these new laws go into place, school officials will face lawsuits even when they're ignorant about the student's statements. So if somebody bullies somebody on Facebook and they don't know about it, they could still be sued. And a member of Facebook was interviewed, and he said, quote, "We're adding a unique feature developed with safety experts that lets people also report content to someone in their support system, like a parent or teacher, who may be able to address the issue more directly." So this sounds like this is going to be a Facebook-wide feature, probably only pushed out to students people whose ages are lower than 18, I would assume.
Right.
Like, you wouldn't need this on older people.
No, I think we need it for adults as well.
But I mean, Facebook doesn't even really do any age verification. So I don't know how they would enforce this. I mean, if I was a kid, I would just sign up and say my age is 30.
Well, when you join certain networks, wouldn't you kind of be opting in? So if I go on and I say, okay, I belong to this high school network, then maybe that triggers something that opts me into their monitoring.
I agree they could do that sort of thing. But who it's kind of funny you bring up networks. Who the heck uses the networks anymore on Facebook? The other week, I was looking at my profile, and it said, you're a member of these networks. It took me 45 minutes, I shit you not, to find where you could edit your networks. It's, like, totally not apparent anymore. Like, networks don't even mean anything.
Yeah, and you can still only join, like, what, three or four?
Yeah, it's really, like, work, school, and something else.
Yeah.
Regional.
I mean, they've kind of integrated things that you put into your schooling, your work. Like, all of those things that you put into your bio page kind of are default networks, like they're groups that you're joined to.
Right, but
people
they don't,
can search
they,
on them.
Your networks are still separate.
Right, they're still
that.
Separate.
Yeah.
But it's like they still have networks, but they also made everything in your bio, quote unquote, a network.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they're doing there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck enforcing this one, federal government.
Yeah, stupid federal government. Seriously. So our next story kind of goes along with a lot of things that we've been talking about for the past couple weeks about websites turning on an option for enforcing HTTPS. You know, Gmail did it, Facebook did it, now Twitter did it. I don't know that there's much to say about this. Anthony, do you have anything to say?
Seems like a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Ryan.
Yeah, with the fire, with the launch of that FireSheet product, I think this is basically it's an awesome idea. The only thing that I still wonder, and I haven't seen like any, I mean, maybe I haven't researched enough. Why can't the browsers just like encrypt the data behind the scenes that have your session variables and all sorts of stuff? Like, why are they allowing it to be accessed?
Well, there's a, I don't know what it is, whatever sort of RFC or something goes into place to add a new HTTP header. Yeah. Like, there is a header that does that. It's just not all browsers support it.
Oh.
And the thing to point out about this is that even though there's a checkbox that you can check this to encrypt Twitter, it's only on the web page. Like, yeah. API access, mobile access, still unencrypted if the developer doesn't do it on his own.
Right.
Like, just because... So that's one thing to point out. If you use Twitter on the web and your phone, even though you check this on the web, your phone is probably still unencrypted.
Right, but you're not vulnerable to the FireSheet attack because that's central right. to Windows, right?
Well, no. FireSheet is on, like, every platform. Oh, I really? Can get it on my Mac, yeah. But FireSheet is only a problem on networks that other people can get on and run the tool. So, for instance, a cell network, you're not going to get your laptop connected to the internet on a cell network, so you can't see that data.
I see.
So, yeah, I mean, even like people, whenever they go to conferences like DEF CON and Black Hat, where it's a collection of hackers, you know, they tell you, don't use the Wi-Fi, use your cell phone, because people can't get on that.
Yeah.
I guess the more interesting question to me is, why wouldn't a website enable this?
As far as big websites, they should. Yeah, absolutely, they should. Smaller websites, like my personal website or whatever, that are virtually hosted, can't do it because SSL doesn't work on virtual hosting where the virtual host doesn't have its own IP address.
It would also cause some performance issues, too. Maybe it would add latency.
Yeah, it would slow down
no
stuff.
No caching.
Yeah.
Well, and the fact that it costs money to get a certificate, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they're expensive. I mean... There are places. What was that one place we used to use for email? Oh, what was the name of it? But whatever, they gave out certificates to encrypt email.
For free.
For free. A while. Yeah. This is going to kill me until I remember. This has happened, like, this is the fourth time this has happened today where I've thought of something. It was on the tip of my tongue. I couldn't say it, and I need to look it up. So, Ryan, I believe you have the next article about some operating systems.
So I saw this article. On geek.com, and basically it talked about, you know, simplified these, all these overly simplified operating systems, like, you know, Android, maybe not so much Android, because I guess you can still get out to like a Linux shell and stuff, but iOS, BlackBerry OS, especially since iOS has now kind of made an appearance in the like iPad world, and this is being sold as like an end computing device. Not just like a
post
phone.
PC.
Yeah, post PC. So the article talks about will these simplified operating systems kill future innovation? Because I know I connected with this article with the writer because he talked about how, you know, the complexities and the nature of Windows and DOS back when he got his first computer are what, you know, drew him to the industry and why he got interested in it. And I felt the same way. And will that sort of stifle interest from other people? Like, will, you know, the fact that these things are just simple and there's no, you know, you can't go and like customize an iPad on its own without a PC.
Yeah.
Will this kill that interest? What do you think?
No, I definitely agree with that. I mean, for those of you who don't know, I'm a college professor at two different places, and I see this in a lot of my students where, like, when I was in college, when I was going through school, I wanted to tinker. Like, if I saw something happen in an operating system,
I did say tinker.
I wanted to figure out why that happened, change it so it did something else. Like, I wanted to get into the nuts and bolts, and I don't see that mentality anymore in the students because, you know, I think, you know, with things like an iPad, an iPhone, you know, these operating systems that hide that stuff from you, the interest just isn't there, or maybe they just don't know it's there to go looking.
Right.
I mean, what do you think, Anthony?
I kind of disagree with you guys. I mean, I think these operating systems serve a specific purpose, and we kind of get caught up in the marketing. I mean, of course Apple wants you to replace your PC with an iPad. I mean, that's more money in their pocket. But I mean, if you've ever been to a website like the XDA developers, you know, there's a ton of hacking going on with these devices. There are people that tinker with these devices. I mean, there's hacks out there that you can root the device or jailbreak the device straight from the device. You don't even need a PC.
Do you think, though, that this or the group of people doing this is a lot slimmer than when we were growing up going through school? Like, it seemed like anybody who was remotely interested in technology, you know, took a basic class or, you know, knew something about computers. They wanted to fiddle. Whereas now people are growing up with iPods, iPhones, iPads.
I'd say as a percentage, yes. Like, there's probably as per capita, there probably are less people that are interested in this, in hacking, because computers are so widespread now and proliferated or whatever, or prolific. But one-to-one, no, because I just think because there's more people, there's also more people into the hacking and like customization and like tweaker homebrew type, you know, that sort of like that whole world.
Right.
And the internet makes it easier for these people to connect. I mean, when we first started, you know, it was word of mouth.
Bulletin board systems.
Yeah. How did you figure out?
Yeah. I can remember like just trying to find people in my town that like knew about computers. And that was a challenge.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. I was the computer person in my town. Like, there was
nobody
else.
Well, I quickly rose to that position.
I mean, even when I didn't know anything, I was still that guy. Like, that's how little computer knowledge there was around where I grew up.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, we said everything we need to say about that.
Yeah, it's just an interesting article.
That is. And
you know, one thing I'll say about those operating systems, I think that in certain cases, abstraction might lead to further innovation. You know, maybe you don't have people that are worrying about, you know, low-level operating system details, but maybe someone can take this device and make some higher-order program that does something innovative.
So you're saying the abstraction is going to make more Steve Jobs?
Perhaps.
Because, you know, the high-level thinkers, he doesn't have to worry about code. He just says, this is what I wanted to do. Do it. I see that. So what's this about the Nissan Leaf?
Well, I've put this article up basically. So, you know, there's this big push for electric vehicles, and I'm a skeptic on the technology side of this stuff because I see the challenges that are presented by the energy that a car needs to do what it's to do its job. So even in the, you know, best case scenarios for like a internal combustion engine, an EV can, you know, present maybe like a 3-to-1 improvement in efficiency, because modern internal combustion engines, you know, gas diesel engines are about 25-30% efficient on the high end, and electric vehicles are in the 85-90% region. If you consider the fact that the electricity was produced by, say, nuclear power, if it's produced by coal, like, forget it, it's worse. But that said, you know, it's a cool technology, and it does have this like efficiency improvement. But battery technology just isn't there yet in terms of storage, and so this article talks about how there's a lot of anxiety among these Nissan Leaf owners that, you know, they're running out of juice on the road, and it's worsened by the fact that the software, the prediction software inside the car, isn't living up to its, you know,
it's not actually predicting.
No, it's it's saying, hey, you got 40 miles left, and then the car shuts off. That's terrible. Like, I mean, at least with a gas gauge, you know, it's they're typically like mechanical or electromechanical in the sense that there's mechanical sensors in the gas tank that take some reading, you know, based on
they're pretty much going to work.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's physically broken, like where it's, you know, it's not a design flaw.
Right.
But anyway, you know, or you can at least learn it like over a couple days of using or a couple tanks full. You can say, oh, well, I mean, I've never run out of gas in a car, knock on wood. But
I think that's fake wood, but
that's never happened to me. But you know, these EVs they're relying on software, computer systems to determine their range, and I think that's a pretty big I don't want to say a flaw, but a weakness. What do you think?
I thought this was funny immediately once I saw it. I wanted to try to make some like wordplay or something, like the Nissan Leaf gets left behind. I was thinking of something, but I couldn't come up with anything.
Yeah.
Anthony, you looked like you had something.
Was it really 40 miles that it was dying?
I don't remember the exact number.
I thought the article mentioned like 10 miles or less or something. I got the impression that these people were kind of playing chicken with the device.
I've run my car down to zero, like where it says zero, you know, like my little like trip computer says 0 miles to empty. And I've driven a solid 20, 30 miles, no problem. Like, because I just, you know, like I push it and I'm like, oh, I'm in town. I'm like, I'm 100 feet from a gas station at any given moment. I don't really care.
Yeah, like I know with my vehicle, I know when the the low fuel light comes on, I can drive from Ebensburg to New Florence.
Yeah, that's a hike. I mean, that's what, like 15 miles or something.
That's a good way, yeah.
It's going downhill too, Kevin.
That's true.
Yeah, yes. So, I mean, that's definitely, circumstances definitely affect that. But you know, to say 10 miles left and then shut off, that's different than saying 0 miles to empty and you've still got some reserve.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. You know, said, you got enough juice to go 10 plus miles, bam, shut off. It's like, really? Really?
I don't know. I mean, I find, you know, I have one of the trip computers in my car as well, and, you know, I watch it count down, and it kind of jumps over all over the place sometimes, and, you know, they say, like, it's based on your driving habits and whatnot, so I just have an inherent trust in that to begin with. So when I saw that this happened, I kind of wasn't surprised, and yeah. I thought it was funny as well. I mean, kind of, I guess it's, you know, what you get for being an early adopter.
Yeah, as far as trip computers go, you know, those are things, especially predicting your MPG. You know, if you're going up a hill, your MPG immediately goes down. But then once you get off the hill and it evens out, MPG climbs back up on the trip computers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely depends on the weighting they put on the measurements.
Yeah, so like if you slam the gas pedal, all the numbers go out of whack. Once it evens out, you're good to go. It's, yeah, software flaw. So I don't know what you guys think about this. This has been a long time coming, but no pun intended. But I just thought of that. But ICANN approves the .xxx top-level domain. We've heard about this for a while, but now it finally happened. And here's what I want to know. Whether this is just there for porn sites to use, or whether they will force all porn sites to switch to .xxx. What do you guys think?
I don't know. They didn't say anything about forcing them. In some ways, it would be good for them for advertising purposes. Like, you know, hey, this is where you find all the porn. just, you know, come to XXX or .XXX.
The red light district of the internet.
Coming soon.
Exactly.
Kevin Slonka .XXX.
That's a good analogy. You know, like in foreign countries, they know a lot of the cities have these. Well, I mean, we have in the United States too, but they're well known, these, you know, red light
Amsterdam.
Districts. Right. And like, you know, Hamburg has the Reeperbahn, and so they're just known for this. And in some, like, I think in the best aspect about it is that if parents want to block it, they can.
Yeah, I think this will be good for corporations too. You know, right now content filtering is ridiculous, but now they can just say anything with .xxx, done.
Yeah, on the bad side, I think this can be used to filter things. So like your ISP could decide, I'm not going to give you anything in the dot whatever domain.
That would be very Comcast-ish.
It would be, but I think since they're segmenting the internet based on the, like the .com, .net, .edu, .org, really never meant much. That was weird. Never met much. Meant.
It wasn't important.
It wasn't important. I sound like Porky Pig. Anyway. You know, it wasn't important. It never really affected what you could see and what you couldn't see. But now that they're segmenting it by, like, almost like business sector, they could, like, you know, what if, like, all news sites were .news and you had to pay extra to get that?
Dude, that would be very Comcast-ish.
Is this, like, the first step in the whole net neutrality catastrophe?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's another way to segment traffic, you know, and you know, just as an example, your ISP could just charge you more if you want XXX access.
That would suck.
You know, that's just one example.
I mean, not that I'm always going to that. I'm just saying in general.
I don't know what the legal ramifications of that kind of thing are. Like, if they're bound by any, you know, internet agreement that they have to provide, like, right now, I don't think there really is. So without net neutrality, I think that could become a reality. That,
well, I think, you know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, that right now, even though there aren't any laws, there kind of are laws in just the way things work, that if people start screwing with stuff, somebody's going to come down on them.
Well, that's more to deal with antitrust, that you know, we talked about, if you use your power in one domain to influence another, like if you're a video provider and you're a monopolistic venture in that, and then you try to use your market prowess to underbid or undersell or somehow control some other market that you don't have any power in, that could be like considered antitrust. But when it comes to this sort of thing, this really isn't about that's it's not really about that scenario. This is more just like a way for Comcast to make more money based on what features you want on your internet.
Yeah, I could see this turning into like a mobile phone website. You know, if you want tethering, check this box and we're going to charge you an extra $15.
So,
at first I thought this was a good thing. Now I think it's a bad thing. Thanks, guys.
That's what I'm here for.
So our next article, Ryan, talks about some new copyright laws.
Yeah, so I found this really interesting. CNET has a story about the White House. They're looking for a copyright law crackdown. And one of the things they mention is making streaming of copyrighted content illegal on the or a felony on the internet. Obviously, you shouldn't. You know,
are there laws against streaming right now?
I don't think anything specifically against streaming, just, you know, copyright in general, like, you know, copying VHS tapes or DVDs. What I find offensive about this is that, you know, copyright is a it's protected by law, but it's a copyright violation up until maybe the last 20 years hasn't been a criminal activity. It's been a civil thing. So I don't even want to use the word illegal. Like if I like wreck your car, that's not illegal. It's a civil disagreement between you and I. Like, if you let me borrow your car and I wreck it and I don't reimburse you for the damages, it's a civil disagreement. Okay? It's not a criminal one. The same thing is the case with copyright. If you acquire at least it used to be this way, if you acquire some sort of copyrighted work through legal means and you misuse that copyright, then it was a civil disagreement. But now it's become criminal, and not only criminal, felonious, which is much different, I think. And that's what I have a problem with. What do you guys think?
Anthony, you look like you had something to say.
I just feel like it's just a step in the wrong direction. I mean, it's not really addressing what needs to be addressed. I feel like the DMCA mm-hmm. is the underlying problem that needs to be addressed. And this just further solidifies the DMCA.
There's a lot of problems with it, with, you know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that
like everything.
Yeah, pretty much. I just don't think that these things should be felonious. Misdemeanors, maybe. Criminal, I think, is still questionable. You know, the fact that it's even criminal. Because there's a big difference between stealing IP and stealing physical objects. Because you have to prove, in my opinion, you have to prove that there was significant damage to your business entity. I'm not trying to support people that do this, but I don't think you get an automatic go to jail card if you do this, or that companies that own the copyrights get an automatic, like, the FBI does our dirty work for us versus we have to hire lawyers and defend our copyright. There's a difference there, I think, and that's what we're basically endorsing now, that copyrights are the equivalent of real property. Like, even in the, let's like just think about petty theft. There's a difference between grand larceny and petty theft. And they're putting all this stuff into like the grand larceny category. You know, there's a big difference from stealing a loaf of bread and, you know, smashing the windows of a Best Buy and hauling big screen TVs out of there into a truck and selling them somewhere else, you know, for a profit. There's a big difference between that. And I don't think they're making that distinction with streaming video, with digital content, with really any of this. And I think that's what's criminal, the real criminal thing that's happening.
Yeah, what you just brought up was the point that I was going to make, and that's kind of why I asked you earlier if there are any laws against streaming. You know, that's kind of what this thing is going toward. It's not so much the piracy of a DVD or a physical thing. They're saying that right now there are no laws that say watching a movie on the internet through illegal means is actually illegal and felonious.
Yeah.
You know, so they're trying to put laws into place that say whether you buy a copyright or a pirated DVD, like a physical thing, or whether you even just stream it across the internet, they need to update the laws to take that into account since there's no physical property anymore. So yeah, it's like everything is coming under one umbrella now. And yeah, I agree it shouldn't.
Right, it shouldn't. And I think there's a huge difference between real property and intellectual property. That's why they have different names. You know, if there weren't a difference, we would just refer to it all as property. And I don't know. That's my opinion. I'm not endorsing it. You know, I buy all my music now from iTunes. I rent movies from Redbox, and I it's like, I think everyone should, if they have the means to pay for it, should pay for the service. I think it's different to like lend a CD or give some songs of yours to a friend or something so they can listen to them and say, hey, listen to this, or you know, check out a movie to see like if you're really interested in it before you purchase it. But I don't think that, I think, you know, there was a really great discussion on NPR. I think we talked about a couple weeks ago where they said that basically, yeah, copyright law needs revised, but it needs to fit in the modern age in the sense that there needs to be some flexibility in this. It can't just be one way or the other.
Yeah. And as far as paying for things, you know, paying for them legally, this isn't my idea, but you know, you give people the option to get things, you know, get what they want, when they want, how they want, and people will pay for them. You know, yeah. You let them get it on their phone or as a physical disc, however they want it. You let them get the TV show that just aired last night. You know, you let them get it for a reasonable price and people will pay. People won't pirate stuff because it's easier.
Yeah, like a great, I don't know if you saw Matt Hunt's recent article on his blog about the I can't remember which website is it. They're offering like service for like iPad, iPhone, and then like web access. And he gave you the rates, and it totally doesn't make any sense. Like the price structure is just like, oh, so if I want to use it here and here, like not only do I have to pay for both devices, but you're not even giving me a discount. You're charging me for both devices separately, full price, and it's crap. Like there, you know, media has not embraced the fact that their distribution costs have basically gone to nothing. I mean, per unit of sales, bandwidth is a like 1/1000th of a fraction of like what it costs to provide this service.
Have they not embraced it, or is it just they want to maximize their profits?
Well, it may be that, but they're gonna continue to alienate the customer. They have alienated the customer. They have been doing this for probably close to 10 years now. They missed an opportunity, and I think that they're going to pay the price eventually. These companies are not going to be around.
Yeah, and I'm going to jump ahead to the last article in our AV section because this fits right in. Paramount is actually partnering with BitTorrent to release a new movie. You know, you can download it off of BitTorrent at the same time that this movie comes out on DVD. So what do you guys think about movie studios now partnering with the one service they were trying to crack down on for having all kinds of pirated content?
I think it's a great idea, and I think more movie studios should do something like this. If the movie was good enough, and I would download the torrent, watch the movie. If it was good enough, I would go out and buy the Blu-ray, absolutely.
Right, because I want a high-quality version I can watch on my TV.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is something that I think that they've really missed out on overall is providing free, low-quality versions of their songs everywhere, or songs or movies. And then if you want the high the high def, like, you know, archival quality, this DVD will last 25, 50 years or something, that, you know, you'll go and buy it. And they've totally missed this bandwagon. And they tried something this with this as a deterrent early on in like the back in the Kazaa Morpheus days, where they would flood the what was the network that was on? I can't remember the name of that network.
I don't know.
They would flood that network with like fake files where like they were like maybe low quality, but more like that they were like screwed up in some way, like that it would just repeat part of the song over and over. Or they would even, like, put, like, viruses and stuff. You know, I think there were reports of that, you know, so that you would get a virus if you download a song. So, like, that's one way of doing it. The other way is, you know, distribute your single as, like, as a 96 or less KBPS quality song so that it's, like, you know, it's like, oh, I love this song, but it's annoying. I want a better version. Then they go to iTunes or Amazon. They buy the 128 or 192 kbps version
for $1.
Yeah,
and everybody will do that if they have the chance.
Yeah, I think for $1, especially if there's like a link in the song or in the ID3 tag or, you know, some way of, you know, doing that, or just don't even use MP3s. Distribute it as like a flash thing where like it's a flash video that, because, you know, it's like, oh, if you publicize it as free, people will download it,
right,
regardless of what format it is.
So you're saying for the low quality versions, don't even give them the opportunity to download it so that they can keep it and not pay it. Do it as like a flash thing that you have to listen in your browser, or just so you get the idea of what it is.
It could be, or it could just be like some downloadable thing that's terrible quality, but like maybe it has some video associated with it, and then it pops up a web page or something to go and buy it. Like, you know what I mean? Almost like an advertising thing.
Right, like, want the HD version? Click here.
Yeah, if you flood the market with these free, low-quality versions, and maybe that's not the answer, but they haven't thought of any of this. They haven't tried it. They've just basically have found ways to protect their market share, and that's how we're doing it. They just forget it.
Blinders.
Blinders, exactly.
How about artists like Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber that kind of embrace YouTube and the internet? And I mean, you can go out and watch what is like a 1080p or 720p Lady Gaga video online.
Yeah, I mean, these are cool. I mean, it's interesting and cool. Like Dave Matthews, all their albums now are, you can buy them right on their website, download them in FLAC quality, you know, which is lossless. You don't even need to deal with iTunes. People are doing this. They're providing it for some services for free, some services for pay, but it's not the studios.
Yeah, as a general thing, it's individual artists who have to, like, you know, handcuff their label to say, I'm going to do this, don't stop me.
Right.
You know, because labels are the ones cutting, you know, cracking down on this.
I think what people miss in the whole, in all of copyright, this whole discussion, is that it's, you know, these studios are definitely taking it out on the consumer, but the real battle, and I don't know if they realize it, or maybe they do and just realize they can't win, is not between them and us. It's between them and the people that own the pipes on the internet. Because the distribution model that they came up with was something that was necessary because you didn't have a worldwide high-speed digital network at the time. Now you do. You guys didn't buy in on the technology, didn't even embrace the higher-order level technology, like the not the low-level network, but the services you could have provided over it. You lost. You missed out on the opportunity. You didn't invest. You did not innovate. You lost. So the spoils should go to the people that did invest in the technology, and I think that are those are the people that own the media, own the services that do work on the internet, like, you know, Apple and Amazon. I credit Apple for completely revolutionizing the music industry. That's something that I will give them massive credit for. It's no one else was able to do it, and they did it.
I totally agree. And while we're talking about, you know, cutting content, you know, we go back to the article from Home Media Magazine saying that the number two cable operator, Time Warner, has recently cut its streaming, the live TV access, to the iPad. So they used to offer 32 channels. Now they only offer 15 channels. I don't even know what to say about this. You know, they're just trying to make more money. Like, there is no reason for them to be doing this. You know, the article quotes that they have suddenly become alarmed about the possible compromise of incremental revenue streams and data tracking, otherwise known as ratings. So they're realizing that by letting people watch live TV on their iPad, they're missing out on money they could be making by charging people for watching live TV on their iPad. And that's exactly what Time Warner did. They just stopped broadcasting, you know, over half of their channels. Anthony, have you ever used live streaming on an iPad device?
I have not. I saw a couple different articles about this, and some of them took a different spin on the story. One mentioned that they were having technical issues and that their authentication mechanisms or their authentication servers weren't able to handle the load when the service went live. So
yeah, I think this one cited that too. But
I'm all kind of on the fence, you know, because you know it's not out of the question to have some operational issues when you go live with a brand new service. So you know, the whole conspiracy theory that they're trying to rip us off is definitely you know, something I worry about as well.
Well, the thing that gets me about the authentication issues thing: if you can't authenticate to the service, why can you authenticate to the service for 15 channels, but not the other 17? Like, that's why I don't believe the technical difficulty story, because if you can't authenticate, you can't watch anything.
I'd like to see the list. Did they have the list of the channels in the article?
Yeah.
They removed Disney, ABC Family, Lifetime, those are Disney networks, Discovery, Animal Planet, Viacom networks such as MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, Spike, VH1, Fox networks, National Geographic, AMC, Univision, yeah. Travel Channel, Hallmark. Like, all that's left are news stations, TLC, A&E, HGTV.
So those are the stations that people with money would pay for.
Right.
Right.
Those stations would be in upper tiers of normal cable plans.
That could possibly have a lot to do with it. You know, that they were removing the things that people would probably drop their cable service for. But I don't. Do you already have to have cable service to get this feature, or is this something you could sign up just for the iPad?
I honestly don't know.
It's hard to understand the economics of how all this works, but I know that, you know, I have several friends that really complain about, and I think you've complained about this before too, Kevin, is that there's a channel or two that you want that's in that top package.
Yep.
And it's like. Not only do you like not want to have to get all the other channels in that top package, you have to get a middle package that you don't want any of those channels either.
Right.
And it's crazy. But on the other hand, the way these packages work, I remember seeing charts of, you know, the cost per subscriber per channel to the cable company, you know, and like as a share of the whole, like if a dollar is like equal to like one person subscriber, like 40 cents of that dollar goes to like ESPN, and then another 20 cents of that dollar goes to like Fox Sports, and the rest of it is spread all across all other like 200 channels. So there's some interesting, like there's really like a strange balance between the cost of those channels and how they spread it across. So that has the economics of the cable industry are completely foreign to me, and trying to understand why they do things the way they do.
Yeah, I don't understand how it works, but yeah. I do understand that I don't like the way it works.
Yeah, I don't think that it was a technical difficulty. That just sounds odd.
You know, I've already called up Dish Network. That's what I use at my house, and I've complained, you know, what you talk about, Ryan, where, you know, there's that one channel that I want, but I can't get because it's in some higher tier. So I complain, you know, why don't you guys offer a la carte? And, you know, I get the... They would always say, you know, oh, I'm sorry, sir. You know, this is what we offer. If you're unhappy with our channel lineup, maybe we can credit your account $10 a month for the next 10 months. So, you know, call up your provider and complain.
Yeah, it doesn't get you the channel that you want, but it makes
yeah,
an impact on
you. Might get something
out
of it.
Yeah, yeah, because that's the thing. Like, especially right now, you know, hockey season coming to an end. I would love to watch the Penguins play, but the Penguins always play on FSN and Versus, two channels that are in the top tiers of Dish Network. So I can only watch the Penguins play on the weekends when they play on NBC, because I'm not paying $100 a month to get those top tiers. But speaking of tiers and companies putting out TV shows, what do you guys think about Netflix? Netflix is now getting their own original series deal. If you want to watch this series, you have to subscribe to Netflix. I think this is pretty cool that a completely internet television company, now they're an internet television company, is, you know, doing original material.
Yeah, there was an article, or I don't recall who wrote it or where it was from, but they mentioned that Netflix is basically didn't want to get into the content game, but they're going to have to, because as you move forward with, like, the, you know, as these services roll up higher and higher to the upper levels, like, you know, in some cases, like with, like, internet TV show, or I'm sorry, with TV shows, if you want to get them on the internet, you could get them from, like, Hulu, which was, like, you know, it's like a combination service between, like, NBC and CBS or whatever. And then you could also get them directly from their website. What stops them from just providing it directly to you? Like, you don't even need the website. You just have some, like, app that runs on your computer or a TV with it built in that just connects the internet, and they just stream their shows right to your TV. Netflix is now in this weird, like, limbo. They're, like, in between the content providers and the consumers, and all they really do is just provide, like, a billing structure for all of it. So they have to bring something to the game that's going to keep people that like Netflix and people that don't have Netflix that, you know, want to join in. Otherwise, they're going to go straight to the content providers. But, you know, specifically with TV shows. With movies, it's still a little different, but that I don't see that from being far off, where the movie studios just distribute the movies directly to consumers at their homes.
That would be nice. I mean, I kind of agree with you in that this isn't going to make me subscribe to Netflix. You know, if I want to catch up on a missed TV show, yeah, I'm going to go to Hulu or wherever I can go to watch it. You know, just because Netflix has their own original stuff now. Unless this show, House of Cards with Kevin Spacey, is amazing, mm-hmm. I'm not going to subscribe to Netflix. I don't currently. I don't plan to in the future. But Anthony, you look like you had something.
I'm intrigued. Seems like it could be a step in the right direction, but it's too soon to say, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the article mentions Netflix outbid a number of major cable networks, so it's very clear they have the money to be a major game changer. We just have yet to see whether they're actually going to be that major game changer. So before we move on, we'd like to hear a couple words from our sponsor. At Apple, we take pride in our commercials that showcase our amazing computers, magical phones, and groundbreaking post-PC devices. We believe that through these commercials, we have reached the tech-savvy populace. In our new advertising campaign, we're going in a different direction, making fun of everybody else. If you don't already own an Apple product, you probably won't in the future, and we don't care. You don't deserve to own such a beautiful device. Apple products are for smart people. You're not smart. They're for sophisticated people. You're not sophisticated. They're for people who understand that the high buy-in cost is directly related to a lower total cost of ownership. But we all know that you don't understand math. Apple. If you're not using our products, fuck you.
Wow, that seems like Apple's being a little more aggressive nowadays with their advertising.
I'm sure that came right from Steve's heart.
Yeah, I'm glad I could get them to sponsor the show. You know? That was pretty good. We could pay the bills now. So that was our segue into our large mobile section. And Ryan, I believe you had the first couple articles about Verizon.
Yeah, so there's a couple stories here about the new HTC Thunderbolt. It's been up in the air for a while, but I guess sort of old news now. It's available. It was available March 17th at a nice good old price point of about $250. What's interesting about the Thunderbolt is I think it's the first Android phone on Verizon that's going to support LTE. And, what's the word that Steve Jobs used it's a Hummer sized phone. Which I also saw an article today that over 24% of new smartphone sales are the Hummer sized phones.
You mean like larger than iPhone?
Droid X. Yeah.
The
4-inch screen form factor, 4-inch and larger. So that I found that interesting that, you know, that they're growing so rapidly in market share. And now that we have a 4G version, and, you know, they mention it offers up to 12 megabits down and 5 megabits up, which is pretty sweet. And some of the early tests on this on the device using like the 3G hotspot, you know, are meeting that spec or coming close to it.
Yeah, and that speed is probably only to go up once LTE gets you know, bigger backhauls and implemented in more places.
Yeah, and the other article that sort of went hand in hand with it is that the they're going to possibly, or I guess they're going to offer an unlimited LTE data plan if you get an HTC Thunderbolt, which is interesting. I mean, because right now it's nowhere near that. That's a great deal. And it's something that you may be grandfathered into, hopefully, much like the early adopters of the iPhone have been grandfathered into an unlimited 3G plan.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll grandfather you in. I think that's a little weird just based on, you know, what we heard before about when LTE comes out, carriers were going to give you a capped LTE plan, but an unlimited 3G plan, because they figure that everybody's going to use LTE, so there won't be as much traffic on the 3G network. Right. So that's interesting to see them giving out the unlimited LTE plans, at least for the...
Well, I think it makes sense for the early adopters.
Right.
You know, this is a pretty... I think it's a novel marketing idea. Like, I haven't seen this in previous generations where you give the high data users, the people that want the latest technology, an unlimited plan so that they pay the money up front and adopt these new technologies. And then as the people that come on who probably aren't really going to use the technology all that much, you give them the opposite deal where they get the lower bandwidth unlimited and the higher bandwidth you know, for a capped version. It's something that I haven't seen tried, you know.
Yeah, and I think that they're also, this is kind of like the beta tester plan.
Yeah.
Where the early adopters get the unlimited plan because they're the ones going to crush the network. So now for the first couple months, Verizon gets to see how well its LTE network holds up before everybody else joins. So, Anthony, what do you think? Because I know you use Android.
Yeah, I'm a big Android fan. You know, I had a laugh. You know, I was reading the articles. I sent the link to my wife. We have Droid Incredibles. And I'm like, you know, hey, check out this great new phone. And she's just like, well, it's the same phone that I have now.
It does look almost exactly like the Incredible.
Feature-wise, I mean, I think it adds a little bit of RAM. It comes with a 32 gig SD card, which is really nice. Front-facing camera, but otherwise, you know, it's kind of the same show.
Yeah, but it's got 4G, dude.
Yeah,
4G.
LTE is a big deal, like real 4G.
4G in a city that has a 4G infrastructure.
Yeah, you're right. We don't have that yet. And I think that's something that we have to wait for. I really used to hate on AT&T for that fact that they came out with the 3G iPhone. And I know the reason they didn't come out with it initially is because AT&T's 3G coverage, not only is it abysmal now, it was terrible in 2007. We've only gotten 3G in this area maybe, 2 years ago?
Yeah, it wasn't that long, or you know what I mean.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Yeah. It was, you know, 2 years, and it was after the 3G phone was released.
Yeah, as soon as the iPhone 3G came out, I bought it the day it came out.
Right.
But I disabled 3G on the phone because we didn't have it. I actually found out we had it months later when a friend of mine texted me and said, hey, look at your phone. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I was all confused.
You had turned it off.
I had no idea what he was talking about. But as soon as I went and enabled 3G, bam, 3G popped up. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Yeah it was 6 months later, but it's awesome around here.
Yeah, and obviously, I think the difference here with 4G is 4G's brand new. 3G had been out for years at that point. Well, at least a little while. I mean, Verizon's network had been 3G, quote unquote, for a long time. They had the 1X EVDO for quite some time. So, you know, that was a big difference for us. And I guess you can consider us a rural area in comparison to the big cities like New York and L.A. and Chicago.
I think we'll get LTE, though, quicker than we got 3G.
Well, I think the technology deploys, you know, it's much more rapid than it was initially because they've done this before. It's, you know, they know what it takes to do.
What about backhaul, though? Because LTE is going to need massive backhaul, which means massive cable lays, you know, because 3G backhaul is not going to handle LTE traffic.
I mean, I don't know the specifics of it, but my guess is that they probably have single-mode fiber run into most of these towers, and they're just going to upgrade the boxes on either end. That's my
guess.
Make
it go faster.
You know,
because fiber can handle gigabits upon gigabits of information.
Knowing nothing else about their infrastructure, that's my supposition. But
makes sense. Makes sense. Well, while we're talking about that, let's skip over the next article for a while and go straight into another cell provider. And Ryan, you also, we both submitted this article, but you can lead on that one.
Yeah, so the we got a brand new, well, it's going to be a brand new wireless provider, AT&T. I like the Engadget coined that one, I think. AT&T is put in a bid to buy T-Mobile, and I think basically all that's keeping them from this happening is approval by U.S. regulatory people.
Yep, a pending regulatory approval.
And Sprint has already voiced their concerns. Verizon has said, "So what? We don't care, and we're not interested in Sprint," which I found pretty interesting. They don't, because Verizon's going to lose their title as the largest carrier in the United States. If this deal goes through, I think AT&T will go up to somewhere around, 40% or 50% market share or something like that?
I don't know what the exact number is, but, yeah, they will take over.
They'll definitely be the largest carrier.
The largest U.S. carrier.
Yeah. And, they've cited some reasons that I think it's going to they say it's going to provide a better network experience for their users. They'll be able to expand their network with the newer technologies like LTE and HSPDA Plus with the additional bandwidth that, T-Mobile has. It's good for T-Mobile because they don't have to maintain quite as large a network given the small customer base they had, which I don't know where they get off saying that because I think their network sucked to begin with. They had it in the city. They had 3G in the cities and nothing anywhere else. That's how it was for years. They were starting to improve on that. But, you still couldn't get an 814 T-Mobile number unless you transferred your number. So there was, 814 Central PA for anyone else listening out of the Saudi area. But anyway, I don't know. What do you think?
I have 2 points to make about this. If you look at the article that I submitted that kind of goes along with your article, basically, anytime something big like this happens and it's not Apple, they don't do a big dog and pony show. They do a conference call where investors can call in and listen to the execs talk about this. And people from the Electronista were in on that conference call and live blogged it. And one point that they brought out, which I found pretty interesting, is that T-Mobile does not have any spectrum for an LTE network. They don't own enough spectrum to build out an LTE network. So I wonder why, what the reason AT&T bought them, being that if they didn't buy them, T-Mobile would have gone bankrupt. They would have gone away in about a year because everybody else would be LTE and they just don't own the spectrum to do it.
That's kind of what I read as well. I mean, it sounded like the deal was great for T-Mobile, but I really didn't understand what AT&T was going to get out of it. T-Mobile didn't have the capabilities to upgrade, so, they were going to be stuck.
Well, right, but now what they can do is they can transition all their T-Mobile customers over to AT&T 3G bandwidth and then repurpose the bandwidth that they already own through this T-Mobile merger for LTE and other uses. So you can look at it one of two ways. They can use some of the bandwidth that they have for additional 3G capacity, which, by the way, won't work for an iPhone because I think the 3G bandwidth for T-Mobile is in the 1700 megahertz band.
Yeah, it's different from what AT&T
uses. It's different
than
AT&T. So most AT&T 3G phones, I know specifically the iPhone, I don't know about other phones, will not work on T-Mobile's 3G network. The opposite is not necessarily true of T-Mobile phones. They typically support AT&T's 3G bandwidth.
Frequency, yeah.
So if you have a T-Mobile branded phone, it'll probably work on AT&T 3G, but that said, any phones that don't support AT&T 3G, I've read some other articles that there's some rumors that they're basically going to force customers into, if you want to continue a 3G service, into an AT&T phone, which for Nokia people means and then maybe repurpose that bandwidth for LTE or other uses.
Yeah, and one small thing that I read that AT&T would get out of this is that T-Mobile often has coverage in more rural areas than AT&T does. So by AT&T buying T-Mobile, they can now reach a larger audience than they could with their own towers. And now they also have, you know, you might as well call it rights of way. You know, they can strip down the T-Mobile towers, put up their own LTE stuff, and bam, you have LTE network in rural places.
Yeah, there could be places that they don't have enough density in terms of like towers per square mile to cover the existing population. I don't think they're going to gain much in the way of rural coverage because T-Mobile's network just was not rural in any sense of the word. You know, they focused on the cities, which is a smart business plan if you're trying to get into the market. It's a poor business plan if you're trying to capture the market once you're already in it, I think. You know, I think that's why Verizon does so well is because their rural coverage is bar none the best.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Now, like we said, it's not a done deal. Both companies have agreed. Deutsche Telekom, who owns T-Mobile, they're like, yep, AT&T, you can buy us, no problem. So it's just regulatory commission that has to say yes or no. And every other company, like you said, is saying, we hope they say no.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sprint's putting up a fight. Verizon's like, whatever, we don't care. I mean, and I thought it was interesting that not only in that same sentence did they say they didn't care about the merger, that they didn't care about Sprint either. And it makes sense because, you know, Sprint jumped on the WiMAX bandwagon for good or for bad back in, 2009? And everybody's like, you guys know that the company that provides your chipsets, Qualcomm, also jumped on LTE. So if you want to make phones that are both 3G and 4G compatible, you know, in terms of the Wi-Fi 4G, you're going to need to have two chipsets in your phone because whoever's providing the 4G WiMAX chipset is going to have to either license the technology from Qualcomm to get the CDMA compatibility or who knows what. I mean, it's like just super dumb move on their part, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it was already bad enough that we had two technologies in terms of CDMA and GSM in the States. Yet, Sprint had to go and add another technology.
Right.
WiMAX.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. For the people who go on the TV and say, you know, we have the best plans ever. They're the cheapest. They allow you to do the most. You know, that seems to be a smart move, but then they make a dumb move
like that. If you live in a city and you don't have Sprint, I don't know why you don't. I honestly don't. Like, if you never leave New York or you never, you know, rarely leave like Pittsburgh or a big city, and you don't have Sprint, I don't really understand why you don't.
Yeah, Sprint is most often rated the best in places that has that coverage.
Right, in speed.
Yeah, speed.
Speed and that sort of thing. And it's the cheapest. There's no reason not to have it in a city. I don't understand why people don't embrace it, other than maybe they just don't like the phones that are on Sprint.
Yeah, what phones are on Sprint? There's like the Evo 4G. That's your only choice.
I mean, it was popular when it came out. But any Verizon phone, 3G-wise, will work on Sprint's network. 4G-wise, uh-uh. So,
yeah, we'll see what happens. So we have a couple Apple articles. This one, Anthony, I know you're very interested in. So I'll just go through and talk a little bit about it. So apparently some developers have been finding out that now, before I say that, everybody knows that there are multiple ways to run applications on an iOS device, whether it's an iPhone or an iPad. You could download the dev kit and make a native application, or what Steve Jobs recommends is write an HTML5 web application and you can run it, and you know, you can run it in such a way that it looks like a native application.
The porthole to Apple's kingdom.
Yes. So what developers have been finding out is that if they go the route of the HTML5 web application and they give people a link to add it to their home screen, so it puts an icon on the home screen that they can launch just like a regular app, these developers have been finding out that the app is running roughly 2.5 times slower than if you just opened the website in Safari or if you had a native app.
Hole closed.
Yeah. Now, these developers have found the reason being is that there are two JavaScript engines on an iOS device. The new Apple Nitro JavaScript engine, the fast one, that runs from Safari if you just open up the web browser. But that engine is not used when you launch a web app via an icon on your home screen. Now, Anthony, I know you do some iPad development. What do you think about this?
This is just Apple's attempt to push everyone to the App Store to buy apps. It infuriates me.
They're closing the hole.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, you could maybe make an argument that, oh, they haven't enabled this new Nitro Java engine in the general OS portion of the thing. But there's reports also that there's cache areas that the developers have now lost access to that they used to have access to if they developed web apps. It's gone. So to me, this is just Apple closing the hole.
Yeah, and here's another thing. There are some people who, whenever they write an app, they will write the app in HTML5 as if it was a web app. But in order to get it into the store so people can buy it, they just put it in a native frame, basically. So the app is still HTML5. It's just running in a native, what is it, object-oriented C++?
Objective-C?
Objective-C. Yeah, it just runs in an Objective-C shell, but it's still HTML5. And these people are saying, yeah, we lost access to things. APIs don't work as fast. Like, it's really hampering a lot of developers. Anthony, have you noticed any speed reduction on things you've done?
I have not. I have seen the services, though, where, you know, it's kind of a web service where you would go build your app on, like, in the cloud even, and then you can deploy it to the store in a container.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way a lot of people who didn't want to learn Objective-C went. I mean, how easy is that? Anybody can make a web page.
Well,
okay. Maybe I shouldn't have said anybody, but you guys get my point.
I mean, anybody can make a web page. I agree, but making one that performs well, like a desktop app in HTML5, I think is still a bit challenging.
Yeah, making it look good, you know, is kind of easy because Apple does have APIs for their buttons and everything. You can make HTML5 apps look like native apps, no coding necessary. You know, it's just kind of part of it. But yeah,
bad Apple. This. This is, you know, in response to, I think, last week or week before, we talked about some of these, Amazon just releasing their Kindle app in HTML5, and they don't have to abide by that 30% cut that Apple wants to take on all books.
Because it doesn't go through the store.
Which that doesn't even apply to them until they update the Kindle app, but once they do, they're screwed, you know.
The thing that really bothers me about this is, you know, I get the feeling that right now people already have this big push for apps. Everything has to be an app. And there's not a real good understanding of HTML5, just in the general public. And as a developer, I'm getting requests for apps. Everyone wants an app. And I always want to take a step back and say, well, what are your requirements? And when I get the requirements, they're so simple. I say, well, you know, this really doesn't need to be an app. Let's just do it in HTML5.
So you're saying more like the commercials have brainwashed people. People don't know what an app actually is.
Yes.
They just want something they can run on their phone and they call it an app.
Yeah.
I can see that happening. I mean, especially with the new round of commercials, you know, our sponsor that you just heard a little while ago making fun of Apple's commercials, because their new commercials are basically making fun of every phones that don't have app stores.
Yeah.
They're like, if you don't have an iPhone, you don't have the app store. And that means you don't have this awesome app that does this.
Yeah. You know, speaking of app stores, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but what do you think about these lawsuits with Apple protecting the App Store trademark or the term app?
Like, people can't use the word app anymore?
Right. Like they invented the word. Like, I don't know. When did we start using the word killer app or the phrase killer app? Way before the App Store.
Back in tech TV days.
Yeah, what's the next killer app? App is definitely been an abbreviation for application.
Forever.
I think I read an article that said they found instances back in the early to mid 80s. So, I mean, this whole App Store trademark thing is just ridiculous. Because I guess they're going after Amazon now for the Amazon App Store. Their App Store is one word with a lowercase s on the store, you know, like instead of two words. But they're still going to go after them.
So now we're getting into semantics.
Yeah, and they're going after Microsoft because I think Microsoft calls theirs the App Store as well.
Yeah, I mean, this just goes back to my, you know, we had a talk before a couple shows ago about, you know, the whole copyright and IP thing and how I don't think you should be able to copyright or trademark anything like that. You know, I just think that whole system is stupid. But, you know, we disagreed about that. But that goes back to my whole thought that you can't trademark app. You just shouldn't be able to do stupid stuff like that.
No.
Were you going to say something, Anthony? Or?
Not related to the trademarks, but let me ask you guys, let me pose a hypothetical question. You know, say you have your laptops and you have a flight booked somewhere and you want to check the status of that flight. Would you go and install an American Airlines application on your laptop to check the status of that flight?
No, I would go to Google and type in United 975 and have Google tell me what's up with the flight.
But at the same time, you have a smartphone. People don't hesitate to go and get that app from the airline just to check their flight status.
I was going to do that on my most recent flight. I flew out of our regional airport in Johnstown, and it was a blizzard day. So my flight got delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed and eventually canceled. And I kept looking on Google because, you know, Google gets their flight information from, I don't know where they get it from, but it's awesome. Like, you type in the flight number and it just tells you everything about it. But I looked to see about an app because I thought, oh, I can do this on my phone so much easier. You got to pay.
Yeah.
Like, you got to pay for the American Airlines or United app. I'm like, screw paying. I'll just go to Google.
Yeah. The advantage, the one thing I will say, the advantage of an app, and I think this goes back to what I've always complained about when, you know, people talk about browser compatibility on a handheld device, is the user interface. That the reason people like the apps are because the interface is simple, it's touch-based, or maybe not necessarily touch-based, but suited for the device.
Right, right.
You know, full web experience on a 4-inch screen doesn't work. It does not work. And I don't know how I can impress upon web developers more that you need to develop two versions of your website, one for mobile, one for desktop. If you don't, people will not use your website on the mobile platform. They will not.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that is why I liked using Google to find my flight data, because Google's mobile site is awesome. It looks like an app.
Yeah.
So I searched for United, whatever my flight number was, and it formatted correctly. It was a stripped-down version. It showed me only what I needed. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Now, Ryan, I would challenge you, though. I've done HTML5 applications and handed them off to a user, and they couldn't tell the difference between that and an app.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, that's great. That's what web developer. What I'm saying you should do is design the web interface for the handheld device such that it looks like an app, or it doesn't even have to look like an app. It just has to be easy to use. And the example that I always used to cite, which until recently stopped working, was cnnsi.com. If you went there on your phone, it took you to m.cnnsi.com, and it was the best mobile website I've ever seen. You wanted to find scores for baseball, hockey, football, college basketball, whatever it was. It was like two clicks away from what you know, because if you're out and about, you just want to check scores. That's pretty much what you want to do. And you know, to try and go to the main Flash-based or whatever-based,
yeah,
I don't
multi-column
care.
Multi-column layout. Well,
it could be Java. Yeah. It could be whatever. That, you know, you go to this website. I don't care if you're a web browser, if you have a 2 gigahertz processor, a million gigs of RAM, and you have a fully HTML5 compliant browser, trying to look at it on a 5-inch or 4-inch or 3-inch screen is impossible.
Yeah, it's a pinch and zoom hell.
Exactly.
I hate that.
And even with pinch and zoom, like, which is probably the best way to navigate around a website, it's still a pain. You have to design the HMI to match the hardware. And if you don't, people will they will not use your application.
I definitely agree. Yeah, the pinch and zoom hell, hate it. Because, you know, on websites that don't have mobile versions, I want to zoom in, so I zoom in on a column, read what I want to do. Maybe something else I need is in another column. So now I got to zoom back out, scroll over to the other column, zoom in on that column, and maybe it takes 3 pinches because that's a smaller column, so I need to make it bigger.
It's like zoom, zoom, zoom.
Yeah, exactly. That sucks. Yeah, Nobody wants to do that.
You just need to present. And another good example of a really good web, small screen web format is Wikipedia.
Wikipedia is good.
Their mobile browser or their mobile version of the website gets you what you need.
Everything is minimized by default.
Yep. So you can like quickly scroll like the history section of something, click on it. It's all one column. There's no side to side scrolling. Very smart.
Web developers, take notice.
Yeah. I'm not trying to pick on you or anything.
That's cool.
So we have a couple more Apple articles. One that I found interesting given that the iPad 2 just came out. And it is about the iPad 2 smart cover. So have all of you have seen, you know, pictures or videos of the smart cover and how amazingly magical post-PC it is, right? So
I have a cover for my PC. It's called a laptop bag. The screen never gets scratched.
I honestly can't wait until this thing comes so I can play with it and have so much fun as the people in the videos are having. think I'm really looking forward to that. But basically, some estimates have been done showing that these things are going to make Apple $1 jillion. Like the final revenue figure just on sales, assuming that for each iPad a smart cover gets sold, is $1.04 billion. So, I mean, the estimates were done saying, okay, so not even everyone, I lied. They were estimating that for 60% of the iPads that get sold will get sold with a cover. An average price of $48 and sale of 21.6 million covers, 60% of their sales, they're making over $1 billion on this stupid, you know, plastic or leather cover.
It said that it cost $12 to make.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I would have guessed it cost less, but yeah, I mean, it is.
It says it could add $777 million to the gross margins.
Yeah.
So that means that the cost on those are about 70% roughly, or closer to. Or I'm sorry, there's about an 80% margin on those.
Yeah, so that's about exactly the number Anthony just said. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, out of that margin comes their development costs and all that stuff. But still, on the gross margin, that's still really, really good.
Yeah. And here's the thing, though.
I mean, there are companies, not to interrupt, there are companies that don't make as much in the business they're in as Apple will make on selling this specific accessory.
Right.
Just the specific accessory.
Right.
Not to include all the other accessories.
Right, like the HDMI adapter that I bought for $50.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
That's where they get you.
But yeah, I mean, think of this, though. How long have magnets been around? Forever.
Yeah.
Literally forever. Nobody has used them in a way like this until Apple. You know, this is kind
of... Wait. In what way?
Look at this. You have a cover, super thin. Nobody thought of having a cover for your laptop or anything that snaps on via magnets, that triggers a sleep sensor via a specially placed magnet.
The sleep sensor, I will disagree with.
Well, BlackBerry did the sleep sensor.
Yeah, they've had the magnet inside of their
pouches.
Their pouches long before this.
Yeah, so BlackBerry did the sleep sensor, but...
And magnets, like even my laptop here has a magnet that keeps it.
That's how
it
closes instead of like a button that you have to press.
Right.
But I mean, think of it though. Apple makes magnets. Everybody goes nuts. You know, really?
Well, I think the reason people are going nuts is not because of the magnets though. It's because that there was a problem that they created. Their first attempt at the iPad cover was a miserable failure, in my opinion.
Well, I don't think they created the problem. I mean, the tablet itself created the problem of an open-faced device.
Well, right, but I mean, their first solution to it was just terrible. Like,
oh yeah, it was.
You know, for example, like the one that they sell, the way it meets up with the headphone port, like you can't fit some headphones into it. Except their headphone.
And if dirt gets in, it scratches up the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely screwed up the design of their first case.
You know, I'm kind of curious. I'm not a big Apple guy. Maybe you guys have an opinion on this. You know, how big is the market for Apple accessories that aren't made by Apple? Because, you know, like I've been in Target and I've walked down the electronics aisle and see like that. And I can, you know, I know it's not made by Apple.
Now, I can't quote sources because I don't remember, but I remember hearing this, that the market is so huge that all it takes is for one company to make one accessory and get it placed in an Apple store, and they are set for life. Like, getting your accessory, one thing, in an actual Apple store, they make millions.
So then when you put it in that perspective, you know, what Apple's doing isn't that amazing. They're just kind of taking back some of that market to themselves.
Oh, that's exactly what they did.
Well,
they
gave up a lot of that market early on to like companies like Belkin and Griffin. You know, they had a lot of those products were endorsed by Apple. Like, you know, early on, all of the Apple car kits for the
they were Belkin.
Belkin, yeah. I still have my original Belkin car kit.
Mine's in my car right now.
That I got, you know, in 2003 or something like that. It still works with my current gen iPod. And actually, I've had to repair it a couple times. And the reason I've done that is because you can't buy that specific one anymore that has the built-in headphone jack. And
yeah, I mean, this was definitely a money play. You know, Apple noticed that they were losing out money on cases during the first iPad, and they said, we need to fix this. We need to make some money back. So let's design one that nobody else can do because, you know, yes, they give out specs for the iPad to all the accessory manufacturers. They never told anybody about the magnets.
Right.
So nobody knew. So the first round of iPad 2 cases, crap, same as the iPad 1 cases.
Yeah.
But now that everybody knows, all the third parties now are going to be making magnetized
cases. All they do, though, is patent it. If they patent it, there's no way they can make any money on the magnet-based ones.
Yeah. Yeah, but this was definitely a money play, and as the article states, they are raking it in.
Yeah.
So our last article of the day is something that's been talked about for quite a while, and not just in the Apple realm, but of mobile phones having NFC or near-field capabilities. Basically, some credit cards have the chips in them that you can just hover it over a reader and it'll pay instead of having to swipe a credit card. There has been recent talk about phones having that built in. So you open up the app on your phone for Visa or MasterCard, swipe it over the reader, and you don't have to carry credit cards with you anymore. You can pay for things like that. And there are reliable sources, somebody within Apple, saying, yes, the iPhone 5 is going to have this. Now, my first question, do you guys know if any other phones have this?
There's some Android phones that have it. I think the Nexus S has it.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if this was going to be one of the first ones coming out or if people have already seen it in the wild.
I really like this idea. I think they could extend it to the car manufacturers, you know, so you could like turn on your car remotely. Well, they already have the, you know, their app, but like, so you don't even need your key anymore.
Yeah, because a lot of the newer keys, they work on proximity.
Yeah.
You get within 10 feet of your car, it opens. Now just have your phone do it.
That would be really, really cool. I would really like that a lot, actually.
If you're an Apple person, you probably use iTunes. You have your credit card already synced up with iTunes. So, you know, it would be, you know, the system would work pretty seamlessly that you can, you know, pay for something. It just charges to your iTunes account or, yeah, you know, goes straight to your credit card.
Yeah. The one thing I might dislike about that, though, is how the charges show up on my credit card. Like, I like my end of year credit card statement, how it separates everything out: automotive charges, restaurant charges, you know, entertainment charges. I use that whenever I'm doing my taxes to go through and see what can I deduct, you know, what was charity that I donated to. If everything
that
goes
still
through,
should work, though.
But if all of your charges are charged to iTunes, everything that shows up will be coming from Apple, so it'll show up on your credit card as an iTunes charge.
No, that wouldn't happen because the purchases would still go through the point of sale that you scanned your NFC at, you know, your NFC device. Because they're processing the purchase, not Apple. Now, maybe what you're saying is maybe that it would transfer the data over from your Apple account into the NFC like chip.
Okay.
You know, so then it would just be pre-programmed in for you.
Yeah, I was assuming that your iTunes account would provide the credit card information.
Okay, so just so you wouldn't have to enter in your number again.
I don't think that they would process it, because that would require an internet connection and stuff.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, you should have an internet connection, but like, what if you wanted to like pay for something and you had no 3G service or something?
That's true.
So I think it's just, you know, it's going to... That's a good idea that they could just transfer your Apple account and info in and you wouldn't even have to do anything. But I think the processor is still going to be the point of sale, whoever they subscribe to, like whatever bank network that they're on.
Yeah, that makes more sense. The more I think about it, the more I think I was just an idiot and didn't think that through.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But.
If you want to learn some more about NFC, check out Ars Technica has a really good primer on all things NFC, and it goes through in very very good detail. Some of the crazy things I've seen proposed are using NFC to establish communication and then hand that over to another protocol. And something crazy like, you know, you walk up to a big screen TV and NFC uses that to establish a wireless communication link. And then instead of, you know, plugging in an HDMI cable, you get your screen beamed up to the big screen TV.
Interesting. So kind of like Apple AirPlay or other devices that transmit wirelessly. Not a bad idea. And then it would be a standard that everybody would have to conform to, unlike Apple AirPlay.
Which they like, I don't even think they'll license the damn thing.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in anything else. So have any of you guys seen anything that, you know, you want to talk about? Anything we didn't cover in the show happened this past week? I know there's one extra article I wanted to bring up that we didn't put in, and that was the attack on RSA. So I don't know if everybody heard, but RSA recently had a major security breach, and I don't have the article. I'm going to try to bring it up as I'm talking about it. Anthony, maybe you know more details about it than I do. But basically, RSA servers were hacked, and the part of the servers were hacked that I recall from the article, Ryan and I were talking about this earlier, and we couldn't come to an agreement on what parts were hacked, but I believe it was the part that deals with the code for the key fobs. And it has become so much of a big deal that the company we work for has immediately disabled all RSA key fobs.
I did read that RSA came out and said that their clients didn't... weren't in any kind of danger, but you know, you still have to wonder. You know, they're not being very open about what exactly was stolen from their servers.
Yes, the one article that I read, I'm going to try to find it, mentioned that the what was stolen was code that produces the random pins on the key fob itself. However, other articles say that, you know, RSA, you know, they're downplaying it. Their list of what you should do to protect yourself is just a basic laundry list of things you would do to protect yourself anyways. So, you know, Ryan and I are both frantically looking, trying to find this out. But basically, let's just assume that it was their code that produces those pins. That's a really big deal. Like, every company that allows remote access to their network pretty much uses RSA and the RSA key fobs. So this is a big deal that people can now, you know, generate with good consistency, correct pins, and log in as you. Nobody has any. I wasn't able to find it quickly enough.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't found anything. I wish I would have done more research because I didn't realize we were going to talk about it tonight. But I know the article I read. I don't remember them saying it was specifically related to the pin generation for their, because I thought that was based on some kind of like temporal thing, you know, but anyway, it's still scary. I mean, especially when you have a company like this that's so central to the security of so many companies, VPNs, networks, and everything else.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's not that big of a deal whenever it's, you know, other companies, but a company like RSA, they're pretty much the trusted company in, you know, corporate cryptography. So, I mean, when they get hacked, that's a pretty big deal. So, yeah, I've given up on trying to find the article that I found. So, anything else you guys have seen over the week that you want to talk about? Nothing interesting? Yeah, I think we pretty much hit it all. So, that is everything for this episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people go if they want to find out about you?
You can find me at... /RyanLancey on Twitter or www.lancipedia.com.
Anthony, if people want to contact you, where do they go?
I'm on Facebook, Anthony Margucio. That's Margucio, because I doubt many people can spell it.
That's very true. It's Italian. If you want to submit a story for us to talk about, next week's show will be episode 29, so just bookmark it on Delicious as Slongcast 029. And that is everything for this week. Do widzenia.